shot him in the back. 'Cause it's a crime to be black. And don't you act surprised when it gets vandalized. So call it what it is, call it what it is, call it what it is. Murder.
All right, if you found us, you found the White Privilege Podcast. I'm your co-host, Very White Guy, and I'm joined, as always, by Unruly Rev. Thank you, Rev, for being here. Appreciate it. Yeah. White Privilege Podcast. And you know, I play that little intro music, and it's Ben Harper, Call It What It Is, Murder, and it's obviously written about Mike Brown's death. And there was some new, I guess, this was on the notes to talk about for today, but, you know, I put air quotes around new evidence. I guess there's a new documentary Michael Moore is producing, and the Freedom of Information Act got additional video that I guess shows Mike Brown having a interaction, maybe a business transaction, some might say a drug deal, whatever, with the convenience store employees, indicating that the next day it wasn't, and we all knew this isn't new evidence, like, you know, this quote unquote strong arm robbery. But so this other video in the documentary, they're saying supports evidence that Mike Brown did not strong arm rob the place, but rather had made a business deal or transaction, and the employees were holding the cigarillos for him behind the counter or some such. But it's I don't say it's like nonsense and pointless. It's just, you know, it's not going to change anything. Mike Brown's still dead. And we know that was slander to release that video in the first place. But I just, the Ben Harper song in the beginning made me think about it, because a lot of people were, I guess, talking about that recently, this last week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and those of us in St. Louis that were paying attention to the bigger picture of things that were going around knew that portions that were different video clips, and one of them was released, and it was released, the one of the quote unquote, you know, robbery that we also knew didn't happen, because people had known other things that had happened, that it was from the day before, that video clip was not even of the same day that Darren Wilson murdered Mike Brown.
Yeah.
But it was released, I believe it was released the day that Darren Wilson was actually named.
That's correct.
And so, you know, it was very intentional. It was very political. The prosecution and the prosecutor never did act as a prosecutor in that case. He absolutely acted as a defense attorney for Darren Wilson. So,
yeah, and even if I remember at the time, the DOJ said, don't release this video. It is not pertinent. And as you said, they did it the day that Darren was named. And yeah. I think it was like maybe the following Friday. So it'd been almost a week, right? Stuff that had happened. And you could see it I forget who did it, but someone had a social media graph where it showed the number of mentions, like hashtag Mike Brown, hashtag Virgo, all this sort of activity. And as soon as that video is released, the number and volume, it went off like a cliff, because that video did exactly what it was supposed to say. Okay, white people, Mike Brown deserved to die. You know, he was a, you know, whatever you want to, how we're going to demonize him, you can stop caring now, white people. But I don't want to talk about the video, because it's, I don't think anything, nothing new. And like you said, if you were in St. Louis or even paying attention, it shouldn't have been surprising. But you wanted to talk about a few things in particular. I guess as racism has gotten increasingly overt, it's now at the highest elected office and the holy unholy trinity, as it would be. But we thought maybe talk a little bit about microaggressions and more casual racism. So that shouldn't be, I guess, forgotten or ignored. And, you know, certainly it's easy to point out and vilify the overt racism. But for those maybe don't know, let's talk a little bit about microaggressions. Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons that I was thinking about this week is just the fact, like you said, that overt, not needing to be clouded, no needing of dog whistles anymore type racism is just out there. And it's becoming normalized on a regular basis, that's now a norm, and it's being then accepted. And so what can then, I think, get lost is the fact that there's still a lot of racist behavior, activities, things that happen every day, and that then can be downplayed because, oh, it's not as bad as
right.
What Breitbart's putting out, as KKK having no problems showing their faces and being out and proud.
Yeah, and that's actually a sales strategy. Like literally, as a salesperson, you go in and you ask or request something preposterous so that they say no. So then you can ask for something slightly less ridiculous. And the president's doing it now. You know, Donald's doing that with the, you know, first it was 7 countries and it wasn't a Muslim ban, and now it's only 6. It's not as bad. And so you kind of dial it back to the point that it's not nearly as egregious, but then, you know, somewhat palatable, but still horrible. And I think with the microaggression and casual racism, I think it's a good time to kind of just get back to the binary, you know, the non-binary nature of racism. And I think that the more overt racism we see, it leads, I think, some white people to that binary conclusion. Well, that's the, you know, I'm not like them. I didn't vote for Trump. I'm not alt-right. I don't believe those things. I'm not individually in my heart. I don't think I'm racist. So therefore, I'm not. And that kind of allows us as a white people to take a pass on all the myriad of ways we consciously and unconsciously do uphold systems of supremacy without maybe being, you know, overtly hateful in our heart. So I think it's a good time, like you said, to kind of revisit microaggressions and sort of casual racism. And hey, you know, I'm guilty. You know, I'm not, you know, I don't want to speak for you, but I put my foot in it. You know, I'm there's certainly ways in which I uphold systems of supremacy inadvertently, casually. You know, so I'm not above being casually racist. I'm not above committing microaggressions. It has happened. It will happen. I'll do it.
Yep, I'm right there with you with that. It happens. It doesn't happen to me. I do that as well. I try to be conscious of it. One of the articles that I'd read this week, thinking about this, that maybe we'll get to here as we're talking about the casual racism. One of the things that can be difficult about this is you think one of the things that we have to do if we're going to actively try to lessen our damage and to lower the amount of racist, you know, comments and output that we, you know, content that we have in the world, in order to lessen our racism, we actually have to be more conscious of race and racism. And that can be a weird, like, you know, how does that happen? That's a weird paradigm.
But you have to be conscious of it in order to
make a smaller footprint and to do a better job of not committing microaggressions and casual racism. You actually have to increase your awareness of it.
Yeah, here. And I'll use again a statement from my experience. So I, you know, with Leslie, we go a lot of places, we interact with a lot of people. And for a while, I would have this like almost knee-jerk, not instinctual, but just the social conditioning was such that my immediate thought was when I'm at some place and there's a black person they're speaking and I'm talking to them afterwards would be some form of like, you know, that horrible, like, oh, you're so articulate and you sounded so good. And like, that's a microaggression. And I had to get to my own, like, why am I surprised when that is the case? And why is that the first thing I want to say? And how can I, you know, not do that? And how am I going to engage differently? And it's even not that it was hard to do, but I had to really be aware of my language and be like, okay, is this going to come off sounding like, you know, oh, here's a white person saying you sounded so good. Like, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, and let's play this clip that we've got that for microaggressions, that may be a term that some folks that are listening to don't know. And so let's kind of, we've got about a 3-minute clip that we're going to play that will kind of do an explanation of a basic explanation of microaggressions. And then we can dive more into it. So let's,
great.
Let's give this a shot. Are we ready?
Yep.
In 1964, the Civil Rights Act was signed into law, banning discrimination against race, religion, sex, and national origin. While that was a step in the right direction, over 50 years later, America still has racial gaps in wealth, education, and criminal punishment. And an argument can be made for those more prominent racial issues, but what about comments like these?
You're doing chemistry so well because you're Asian.
Where are you from? Because your hair is different than like other white hair.
Osama bin Laden was your uncle, right?
We're talking about microaggressions, which are usually unintended racial slights towards a person of a different race. The term microaggression was originally coined by psychiatrist Dr. Chester Pierce in the 1970s. It was later used by Columbia professor Daryl Sue to define the small interactions and understand the negative impacts they have. If you have never experienced a microaggression or considered yourself a perpetrator, then you're probably white. although everyone is capable of the acts. But we're not just talking about race.
They can be based on race, but they're usually based on intersections of different social locations, race, class, gender, immigration status, phenotype.
It covers a broad scope of people, and once more, they usually occur unconsciously and automatically by the perpetrator. So they may not even realize that what they're saying can actually have an impact. And sometimes the perpetrator may think they're being innocent when they're actually being ignorant. So where do microaggressions come from?
Microaggressions, going back to the definition, are a part of a systemic racism, right? So they don't just happen, right? They aren't just kind of everyday racial slights or comments. There are processes and policies in place.
A 2015 case study on the impact of racial microaggressions explains the framework in three layers. The first are the microaggressions which occur verbally or non-verbally from people who are actually perpetrating, usually unconsciously, from institutional racism. Institutional racism involves the policies, such as the Jim Crow laws in the 1960s, the U.S. Patriot Act, and stop and frisk policing, that can marginalize people of different races, immigration status, and so on. What justifies these policies are ideologies such as white supremacy, which encompasses institutional racism and the racism people perpetuate every day without even realizing it. Basically, white supremacy is like an STD, and racial microaggressions is like the burning when you urinate. It's a symptom of a bigger problem. Unfortunately, antibiotics won't cure racism, but awareness can keep it from spreading before the damage is done.
Self-defeating effects, which can be denying that they happened, self-policing, so being very careful and kind of, you know, self-surveillancing yourself to not confirm stereotypes.
It's important that we allow ourselves to learn how white supremacy contributes to racism, but America has work to do. According to a Pew Research survey, only 27% of whites in America agree it is more difficult to be black in the U.S. than to be white. If we're going to eradicate racism towards anybody just a little different, then we have to open ourselves up to learn how we contribute to the problem.
That last one, 27%, that's a little disappointing. That's not surprising,
Yeah, that's definitely disappointing. And of course, you know, folks that are going to be listening to this, we probably think, well, I would definitely find myself in that category, but, you know, it's like microaggressions. Well, I would never be racist, and then yet you start doing this other stuff. So, yeah, 27%, maybe we're all in there, maybe we're not all in there. And
I like how they talked about the different intersections, and it's a good reminder. I frequently, overly frequently, I really have to work on this, narrowly define things in terms of race and black and white. And I have to remember that the tools of oppression and supremacy are similar, and they're actually the same across multiple different ways of being oppressed. And that the intersections and the things that we're talking about, even like, you know, I'm talking about, we talked about societal conditioning on this podcast, the White Privilege Podcast. We talk specifically about white supremacist societal conditioning on white people, but that societal conditioning has an impact on people of color as well, right? So I frequently fall into a trap of just narrowly talking about it in terms of black and white and race, but microaggressions, class, education, poverty, access to, food, hygiene, right? Like in all kinds of different ways that we can be oppressive and microaggress folks. I'm thinking like I've seen folks go out and hand a couple of dollars to someone who's panhandling, a white person handing money to another white person. And maybe they'll say something like, be sure to get something good to eat, you know, have a hot meal today. And that's an assumption that the person might be going to get booze or something different with the money. You're, you know, making an assumptive on their agency and their how they're going to use that money. And that's a microaggression, but we probably don't think of it as such. And we don't think of it as, well, I'm just, you know, I was giving him a couple of bucks. I want to make sure this person got a good meal. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, and also this, so as the White Privilege Podcast, there's also white privilege hits the intersections around, because white privilege is also part of what is perpetuating patriarchy. Right, so there's misogyny that's involved with that. There's the heterosexism and the transgender anti-transgender bias, that all is connected to and intertwined with white privilege and the pieces that white privilege bring. So those intersections are really important to always keep in mind that, you know, that the way privilege hits, it doesn't even hit equally or, you know,
right,
all folks. So privilege has a lot of intersections to it. And then, you know, oppressing folks has intersections and the way that this stuff plays out in the bigger world. And certainly in our country,
My class privilege, my upbringing of wealth and means, is a function of privilege and white supremacy. And then because I had that class privilege, I was in a segregated, you know, which further, ensconced me in a supremacist sort of ideology. So it kind of compounds itself in both directions.
Without a doubt. And, you know, I'm white, grew up without, in a much lower, let's say lower, class bracket. Then I've heard you describe what you experienced. Grew up in a pretty meager, you know, means in terms of our family for lots of different reasons that aren't important for this. But and yet I absolutely experienced white privilege. There were certain expectations around me around education and around how I was learning and how, you know, what kinds of things were going to be expected of me when I, you know, when I moved on to other grades or when this was happening, that was happening. So the part of the sneakiness of privilege is for folks that are, you know, poor and white or middle class or lower, you know, working class and white can start hearing the word privilege and say, well, I don't have privilege. Look, I had to earn and I had to work for all of this. Nobody gave me anything. And that's the trip up that I think that we have, with just the way language works and the way that white privilege and white supremacy exists is it exists so that white people can pretend like they don't have it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the purpose, is to, you know, be hidden and obfuscated in a way that folks can say, oh, I worked hard and my great great grandfather came over as an indentured servant and, you know, they were Irish and they were slaves and look at me, I've worked hard and I don't fight with the police and that's how you do it. Like that's how you get to that point.
And that's where we get into this idea around that casual racism, the microaggressions that come in is because of not having an awareness of how these systems, not individuals, as you always rightfully point out, not about individuals, but how these systems play in to keep, really to keep the status quo, keep the folks that are on top and to keep the folks that are not, which does, you know, the intersections that hit class and hit, you know, hit gender and hit all the, you know, in all these different ways, ability level, all that.
Yeah. And back to the microaggressions, I'm thinking almost everything that I thought I knew, like that society tells me I should feel about non-whiteness, you know, other than whiteness, the othering impact, it's always negative. You know, it's always an othering impact, right? It's like, well, and that's, again, part of supremacy. I think, like, Leslie's talked extensively about this, and I'll attribute this to her language, that supremacy's kind of purpose is just controlling blackness and black bodies and what black people can and can't do and where they can go and what they can, how they can be educated and what they can wear and how their hair can be. And we see it today. You know, we see it still today. There are institutions and places that ban and outlaw what is natural black hair, right? And mm-hmm. and why do we do that? What, you know, and they'll say things like, well, it's distracting. Or even there's current stuff in legislation where they're trying to get Muslim women to not wear the hijab in certain places, right? So, well, it's distracting to the white students to have, you know, a Muslim student in a hijab. And it's just, that's again about control and what individual can do. And it's that whole othering. And so for me, I had to get to a point where I was like, man, everything I thought I knew is othering. And what I thought I knew is really kind of like tainted and horrible and bullshit. And I still have to admit that comes to the surface, you know, like the implicit bias is still there. But, so, you know, I would say if you're not familiar with microaggressions, when you're thinking something and it's got a stereotype or a, you know, a generalization and a sort of a negative assumptive to it, that's you're in the microaggression territory, and it's a function of anti-blackness and supremacy. But it took me a while to kind of get to the point that it was like, oh, everything I thought I knew was really kind of messed up.
Right, because like you're saying, the function of this is to So part of othering and the function of othering is to also create what is normal, and what is normal is whiteness.
Yeah.
And is, you know, there's certain, being heterosexual is normal. Male is normal. So that's why, you know, you've got basketball and then you've got women's basketball, because basketball is just normal and that's men's. Mm. The thing that's different is it can't just be basketball that women play. No, it's women's basketball, or it's not, you know how that language, like we've got the NBA and the WNBA.
Yeah, good on you. I already said like not even 4 minutes ago that I narrowly define things in race, and I frequently miss the patriarchal conditioning. And that's why I love you as my co-host, Rev. You're excellent at that. But yeah, it never even occurred to me. I've said WNBA, and that obviousness never even occurred to me, that the language is deliberately othering women in that regard.
Right. You've got tennis and you've got women's tennis.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, that, and that, so that's part of this. I think that is part of playing into that othering that microaggressions then come from, is, you know, an assumption. So I'll give an example just from my life. As, you know, being queer, I've got a wife, we've got kids. When one or the other of us goes somewhere with the kids, there's always a question that, you know, maybe we go to a church we haven't been to before, or we meet some new parents at school. If we're not both together, the question is automatically, what does your husband do?
Right? Yeah.
Because the assumption is the fallback. And does it make sense? Yeah, it makes sense. Numerically, you know, statistically, there's more heterosexual couples than there are, you know, queer couples. And so then it becomes, all right, so is this a safe place for me to say I don't have a husband, I have a wife? Is it safe, physically safe? Is this going to change the way my kids are going to be taken care of or treated? I'll tell you, a big place where that happened is when we go to the hospital.
Mm.
Is our care going to be different if my wife is here instead of my husband is here?
Yeah, that was, I think, in terms of the my recollection of a lot of states that were pushing for equal rights in terms of marriage, that was also one of the more common refrains, is just that at a hospital, you know, our hospital HIPAA laws are such that, you know, same-sex partners are just, you know, they've got almost in some states no rights in the hospital.
And some of that is in really big things like rights, right? But when we're just going to fill out forms, and the forms don't reflect, you know, it'll say, you know, the forms are about husband and wife. This, you know, husband, wife, all the forms in the hospital are set up in a heterosexual paradigm, which is what it is, right? Again, numerically, well, what's the big deal? You can do the translation in your mind, but the microaggression is just having to look at that and recognize, oh, right.
This wasn't written with me in mind.
Right. I'm not part of this. I have to be the exception. And so that from, you know, just from my, some of my intersections, which again, we're not talking about race in this, but how the bigger systems work, is just that always that reminder that you're not one of us, you're different. And so how that then plays in, like on the microaggression video the audio that y'all heard, asking people, you know, wow, is your hair always like that? Can I touch it? What does it feel like? That's this idea about, wow, you're different. You're not normal. You're not like me. And that can be, boy, that, so I'll give you an example too. That can be really disturbing for those of us who are white when we hear that that's not an okay, that that's actually a microaggression. That's not just pure, it's not pure curiosity, because the place that it comes from might be just out of curiosity. But you know what? Our actions are not, don't happen in a vacuum. There's a bigger context. There's a more global context that stuff comes from, that while your personal curiosity may be feel very innocent to you personally, but recognize it's part of a bigger.
That's really well said. And I did that with hair. I did that with, you know, my wife's hair and, like, you know, other black women's hair. I would, for a period of time, I thought, coming from a place of genuine and just sort of, you know, affection, like, oh, I really love your hair, it looks great. And, you know, when a black woman's got maybe a wig or a weave or just changing her hairstyle for a variety of reasons, maintenance and care, whatever, and if I say something and make a comment or notice it, I don't know, I felt after a period of time it felt inappropriate. It felt like, oh, you know, maybe said black woman is doing this for a protective day, right? Did a co-wash and just going to wrap it up or do something protective with it. And here comes the white person saying, I noticed it. You did something different and I'm going to highlight it. Say, oh, I like your hair today. And I had to kind of come to terms with what you're talking about. Like, is that, it's not in a vacuum and maybe it is genuine and it on the surface doesn't seem a big deal. But then, you know, I had to sort of really kind of think about why am I noticing it and what does that mean? And what does that say about my opinions about black women's hair? And why am I always thinking I have to make a comment about it? You know what I mean? Like, and that was, I wouldn't say recent, but, you know, only in the last maybe couple of years, I had to like, well, you know what? Maybe the place I'm coming from isn't as pure as I thought. And maybe it's not being received as I thought. And I think that's maybe a good segue. So we've had a couple different examples, your brochure at the hospital, some from the video, I've mentioned a few, where language really matters, right? Just the right framing and the right language. You know, the person that says, what's your husband do? Could say, what's your partner do? Just simple as that. So you shared a document that was about how to be welcoming. And I think it might have been somewhat related to communities of faith and churches, because there's a lot of places that say we're a welcoming community. All are welcome. But what does that mean? And what are individuals and institutions doing to be welcoming? So I wanted you to talk a little bit about, and I think we can include it in the notes here, a link to the brochure, if not, I'll upload it. But really just short, how to be welcoming, right?
Yeah, so there's that language about wanting to be open. We're an open community. We're a welcoming school, or, you know, house of worship. However, that, you know, group. However, that language is used. So there's two different things. There's the intention, and there's the experience and the feeling and the desire on the part of the organization to be welcoming. And then there's a question of, okay, you want that, but how do people actually experience what you're doing to welcome?
Yeah. Right? Is there a welcoming audit? I don't think there's a group that comes in and audits your welcoming ability. So you got to do it yourself.
And yet that might be a good idea.
like right? secret shoppers, like people come in and just, yeah. I mean, honestly, that there's, I know some faith communities that could do with an audit.
Absolutely. So there's a perfect example, right? Where if there's folks that belong to faith communities that are listening to this, you know, you're part of we've got the ushers, or we've got the people that welcome in the morning, the greeters. And if you're a predominantly white congregation, if you're predominantly white congregation, watch how, when folks are like, we want to be welcoming to, we want to become a more diverse congregation. So we're going to be really work on being welcoming. So when that one person of color, that one black family or interracial family shows up, they get overwhelmed. Oh my goodness. You must be new. Where are you from? It's so great to have you. Wow. And like 10 different people come up to quote unquote welcome them. And what it feels like is overwhelming and tokenized and not actually welcome. Really, I just kind of wanted to come and check out what this is. And, you know, now I just feel exposed and I don't know if I feel safe. Right. So
Leslie calls that hyper visibility and hyper invisibility at the same time, so that black individuals' needs are largely unmet. They're invisible. And then within the space and community, they're obviously very visible. So they're getting, you know, bombarded and other things.
Oh, if you belong to either a congregation or a school or a club or a group that is predominantly white, and you have one person of color, a black person, a Native American individual, Hispanic person that's part of it, I guarantee you, if that person's only been part of the group for, you know, a month, their picture's probably going to be on the website or in the brochure.
Yeah, or they've been invited to the, you know, justice group that meets Saturday morning.
Oh yeah. So that's that hypervisibility. Look, see, we've got black people. Look, we got, yeah. this is ours. Right. Which also then that becomes even worse in terms of the possessiveness then of that other, which is a terrible thing that we white, you know, that comes from white supremacy and white privilege, is that possessing of people of color for sure. Which is a whole nother layer around this, which is why this is not in a vacuum. This is all part of a bigger context. So while the intention is we want to be welcoming, but we don't really know how to do it in a way that's actually welcoming. So something like instead of, you know, oh, I've heard this from so many. I've heard it from people of color. I hear it from young adults. When you've actually been coming to the congregation for weeks, months, you've been there, you know, 5-6 months, and yet every time you come, people come up, hi, you must be new.
Oh, jeez.
Hey, are you new? Wow, thanks. I've also heard people say, hey, so are you sure you're in the right place? Is this the church? Or did you mean to go to the Pentecostal church down the street? You know this is a UU church, right?
Yeah. And then go back to the microaggressions. I've, with my wife, entered into stores, and the way that someone will, and it doesn't sound like, you know, you're in your head, you're making it up, very guy. Someone will just come to me and say, oh, you know, hey, can I help you? And the way they say it to my wife, can I help you? It's just different. You know, I'm not going to say, trust me, I know. She knows, and she tells me it's different. Mm-hmm. But the can I help you in a store is really the undertone. What are you doing here? You can't afford stuff here. Why are you here? You don't belong.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So this brochure that had been produced, instead of saying something like, hi, you must be new, which sounds really welcoming, right? Except that in a bigger context, it's not as a better thing to say as, hi, I haven't met you. My name is.
Yeah, or 17 people coming up and saying, hi, you must be new. You know, like right. You said, it sounds good on paper until you execute and say, wait a minute.
Right. This idea around, you know, hey, come meet our other black member. Come on. You know, like, okay, that seems like it's welcoming because you want the idea, again, from this like white patriarchal heterosexist, you know, hey, we've got another transgender person. Come meet them. Like, it's just, it's not useful and it's not actually welcoming. So something, is there any, we got a lot of different groups here. Is there anybody that you'd like to connect to?
Yeah. And we've
those kinds of things are much, it's actually much more welcoming. And what it comes down to is taking yourself out of your perspective. Cause you know, hey, listen, but I would be okay with that. What do you mean? I'd be okay if somebody, you know, wanted to know if I was brand new, what's the problem with that? Well, this is because we're not thinking about your perspective. We're thinking about somebody else's perspective. And so really actually put yourself in somebody else's boots, in somebody else's ears. And even though we can't, because we can't have the cultural experience of, but to think outside of it, all right, if I was coming from a lifetime of people wanting to touch my hair, thinking that I'm different, I'm the only one in this group, and now I got to go through this again, how exhausting. How exhausting.
For real. You know, and you mentioned, and I again, I don't want to narrowly define things in race, but you reminded me that welcoming is beyond race in this way. And really, you know, are you welcoming to individuals that are differently abled, right? Are there stairs? Do you have a ramp? Is there someone there? Do you have, and we've, I don't know if we've talked about this, you and I, but, you know, in our faith, we tend to be, I'm a Unitarian Universalist, I shouldn't say our faith, and our faith tends to be kind of casual. Folks come to service in like flip-flops, t-shirt and shorts, whereas in perhaps, you know, more different communities, black communities, Sunday's really it's a different attire. You go to church in a very different outfit and garb, your Sunday best. And just that alone, what if you come to a UU community and you're in your Sunday best and everyone else is in flip-flops? You feel a little bit maybe different. So have a greeter, have somebody dressed in their Sunday best. You know, there's things that you can do. But again, it's not just race. You know, are people of less means able to visit? Do you have devices for a hearing assistant? All kinds of different ways you can be more or less welcoming beyond just race. But I thought that was a good diagram. Was there any other pieces from it you wanted to highlight?
I think that's good. If folks are interested, they can go on and they can check it out. It's going to be in the notes. I think the bigger piece is that, you know, this thing around microaggressions is they seem, if you're from a dominant group, right, or from the dominant may not be a word that you like, but from the larger group, right, from the one that's normed, it can seem like, why are people so sensitive? Why are people so sensitive? If somebody said that to me, I wouldn't be upset by it. And part of this is we have to realize that these moments are not just that moment that just took place at that time. This is part of a history that doesn't even just go back to this individual's history of dealing with microaggressions. It's a history that goes back, you know, hundreds certainly in this country, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of how non-white people are dealt with.
Yeah.
And just remembering, it's not about your context, and just because you would be okay with it, this is not about the golden rule.
Yeah.
This
and to your point about it being, you know, old as time, this sort of behavior, same with the denying it, you know, the gaslighting in the reverse, right? When we get called out and say, yo, hey, you did this thing and that was bad. It's like, no, I didn't. You're being sensitive. Quit taking that. I didn't mean it that way. Like, so there's even, you know, what was the 27% is the number that agree that black folk have it harder in the United States today. You know, the other 77% think, well, I didn't mean it that way. It's not that big a deal. You know, you're taking it this way. You're being too sensitive. So not only has this instance been, you know, 1 in 1,000, probably that day for the person of color, but, you know, your denying it is like part and parcel with how it goes. That's got to be just infuriating. I can't imagine because I'm not microaggressed in that way. But to be, you know, constantly pissed on and then told it's raining, you know, to constantly be just abused and then said, no, it's not abuse. You know, quit taking it that way.
I love what they said in the video, that white supremacy is an STD and these microaggressions is that burning when you pee.
Yeah. It's a little bit more graphic of an analogy I would use, but apropos. So the next one I thought was great, and it was Cracked has done a couple things. This is going to sound crazy. Cracked, the magazine, has actually editorially done a few things on race and privilege that were, like, I shared them. I was like, wow, this is really good, Cracked. Like, well done, Cracked staff. I'm impressed. But so they talked 5 reasons it's difficult to explain casual racism to your casual racist. And I thought it was good, and I don't have to go into too detail. I thought we can just talk about the 5 kind of briefly. So I'll read the first one. Number 5 is they don't know what your end game is. So they're basically talking about when someone's maybe saying an epithet or a microaggression of some sort, and someone else calls them out, say, hey, you know, that's inappropriate, you did that. The person being called out is like what I just said, goes into this, no, I'm not, I didn't mean it that way, you know, I don't think this, you're being sensitive. So, you know, all this sort of deflection, denial, defense, the sort of white fragility response, according to Cracked, one reason they feel is because they don't know the end game. You know, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to shame the person? Are you trying to make them feel a certain way? When in reality, we're probably just trying to get them to understand that what they did was wrong and to examine why and be better. The end game is not really like that big a usually, I don't know, but for me, the end game's not that big a play, but it's about, you know, who's going to win and what are you trying to
right.
do?
Are you trying to embarrass me in front of people? Yeah.
You called me racist. Like honestly, like nowadays being called a racist, according to some white fragile folks, is like the new racism. Like that's worse than actual systemic racism is being called a racist. When like all us white people are inherently in some way racist, it's a matter of degrees. There is no mythical I'm not at all racist state that doesn't exist, right? Like that just I'm on stolen land in a country that's built on the labor of, you know, stolen individuals. There just isn't the state where I'm going to be free of racist behavior. I can be less harmful, and that's my goal, is to be more and more to do less and less harm as each year goes by. Say, oh, am I living my life in a way that's less harmful? Am I doing better than I have before? And that's all I can hope to do. But getting called a racist, it shouldn't be nearly, and that's against supremacy doing that, but it shouldn't be nearly this, I don't know what white folk think of it, but it's like the worst thing in the world to be called a racist in public, right? To like, I'm going to go to my I statements. I've done stupid shit. I've said stupid stuff. I've been embarrassed by things I've done in front of Leslie, and I've had to like, oh my God, I can't believe I said or did that. I'm so embarrassed. And it did. It took a little while to get over it, but I did. And you have to, because if you don't, you're just going to sit there and like, what, are you going to end every relationship where you say something stupid? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what's the example that Cracked used was in an office. Is this person going to get a new job? You know, like, it was so hard that I got called out for this one thing I said, I'm going to get a new job, or I'm going to accept it and, you know, try to move on and be better.
And you know, we're not going to die of being embarrassed because we screwed up. But actually, the results of how supremacy and white privilege play out in this country, people do die because of that. But we're not going to die. We're not going to die from being embarrassed, from making mistakes. So
no, that's the the t-shirt that's on the Ferguson Response store is Black Lives Are Greater Than White Feelings. You know, there is no white feeling that is going to be more important than black lives. And that's what they're talking about, is in these moments when, you know, we white folk are in our feelings. Oh, you called me a racist. I feel this way. You made me feel this way. I feel like I'm attacked, and I feel like I can't be allowed into the, I feel ostracized because there's an affinity space that doesn't include me. It's black people only. I feel. Nah, fuck our feelings. They're just not nearly as important as black lives. And again, I'll go to the sort of the I statements. I'll get real right now. So, Rev, you are one of my accountability circle. I count on you, and I lean on you at various intervals, to work through my white shit, right? Like, there's things that I need to work through that I don't want to burden my wife with and other people in my life. And very recently, yesterday, within the last 2 days, 48 hours, I had a conversation with you about literally my feelings, right? And I knew, I said, hey, I'm feeling this way, and I know it's not, and I don't want to feel this way, but the feeling is still kind of real. Like, the emotion is still tangible. It's still kind of there. My body's having an actual response, but I know that the feeling's not inherently valuable. I know the feeling is, it's in some way framed, and in my case, it was a little bit more patriarchy than supremacy, but it really helped kind of working stuff and talking it out with you as an accountability peer, and not being fragile with other people in my life. You know what I mean? Like, I could have done it very differently and been like, oh, my feelings. And I remember in the conversation, I said to you, if I had done that, it would inherently taint a relationship, and it would not, it would be, I'm not willing to have this relationship, have this data point, and it change it for the rest of our living lives. You know, like, I knew the gravity of fucking up in that regard. And I didn't. I said, okay, but I still had the feeling, right? So, like, when people say, like, you know, fuck your feelings, and, you know, black lives are more important than white feelings, I want to maybe clarify, they are more important than white feelings, but those feelings are still real, white folks. You know, don't discount that you have a fragility response. It's going to happen. You're going to feel kind of some ways about certain things, you know. Again, go to me. When I fuck up and I do something and it's like, ah, shit, that was framed by supremacy, and someone calls me out, and if they did it publicly in front of other people, you bet I'm going to feel bad. Yeah, I'm going to feel embarrassed. I'm going to feel awkward. I'm going to feel uncomfortable. Absolutely. All that's going to happen in a you know, flurry of shit in my head. But I better realize and figure out what of that is white fragility and not express it in that moment, and just sort of, you know, work it out on my own. And when I do get called out, for me, that muscle that I'm talking about, training myself to not be fragile, it used to be, I'd get called out and I'd have to just sort of take it on the chin and say, like, okay, yeah, you're right. I get it. I'm sorry. I'll do better. And I'd go sit in my fucking bed and I'd stew for a period of time and be like, man, why did I get called out? I don't get it. What happened? I'm not sure. I know I fucked up, so I said I was sorry and I'll do better, but I don't get it. And it would take me a while. I'd still be kind of like, you know, maybe they shouldn't have done this to me and I'm feeling this way. And I'd, you know, over a period of time or talking with people, and over the years, I've gotten better, and that interval's gotten shorter, to the point that I can, in a matter of, you know, fractions of second, within a second, I can actually respond and go, whew, man, you're right. I don't want to get fragile on that. I apologize. But it took work. It actually takes work. But those emotions are real, you know? So I get this first example and why that's hard, because it was hard for me. You know, it was hard for me to hear when I was in my fragility mode to get called out. I didn't want to hear it.
Well, and you're right. Not only are the feelings are real, they're happening. And then you can also have the avalanche of, now I'm embarrassed because I'm having these feelings and I know I'm fragile, and oh, now what do I do? And it can be overwhelming. One of the things that I just want to point out that you mentioned, it's better, it's easier, and I'm going to venture to guess, I've only known you for a couple years, but you've been doing this for a lot longer than the last couple years, but I would venture to guess that over the years, as you've gotten more accountability buddies or people that you can talk to, it also, you probably, when you're trying to do this in your own head by yourself, you're going to spin your wheels.
Yeah.
So you get better, and it'll be faster if you've got folks that are on the same journey with you that you can do, like, have the conversation that we had yesterday.
What was the, and you gave me a, you said a phrase that's apropos, and it comes from,
don't go into your head, that one, that you're, especially when you're in a fragile mode or you're in some of your white privilege behavior that you're trying to stop, don't go there alone. Your head is a danger. It's a dangerous neighborhood that you shouldn't be in alone.
And I totally concur. And I, you know, I reached out to you because I was in my head alone and I was struggling. And it wasn't but a 30-40 minute conversation and a few different touch points. And I had a little bit different frame for it. And I had a lot of relief and amelioration over it. Really, so white folks, you know, this work isn't. So let's talk about white people. We're not doing shit. We kind of suck. We're failing. We're really dropping the ball in a lot of ways. But also, you know, justice work, equity work, internal working on our own internalized oppression. It's not necessarily easy. It's not. You know, it's fraught with pitfalls and problems. And it's absolutely something that is done better with a group of accountability peers and done with, you know, like maybe some support and a coach and something like Safety Pin Box, where you've got, you know, every month measurable, accountable activities that you can do. And then there's a group of people that you can talk to, a closed group of other like-minded white people that are doing this work. So it's that's absolutely important to have. But let's keep going through the Cracked article. Maybe there was a five pieces, and I liked them. The fourth one was, they think only a racist does racist things. So that's the sort of the binary thinking, right? A racist is a hooded Klansman burning crosses on a lawn. I don't do that. One of my friends is black, therefore I can't be racist. How dare you say what I did was racist? And they frequently get stuck in the what I'm feeling in my heart. I don't dislike black people. And it's there's sort of that binary view of racism, and then the sort of individual, I'm not a racist because in my heart I don't think bad things. That makes it hard for folks to get to the point that what I just did was racist.
Yeah, and that gets to this. The binary, I think, is a good way you talk about it, that a racist is kind of a monster, right? And I'm not that. But all right, so if some of us that are doing this kind of work and we're the ones actually pointing it out to other white people, maybe we need to also look at how we're doing it in our language around, you know what, that's racist behavior. What you just did, that's not okay. And yeah, Here's why it's not okay. Because the hearing, and it may even be that you're not saying that, but the way that things get interpreted is, oh, so you think I'm a monster? Well, screw you. You're just being politically correct. And then any possibility of changing behavior, this is, again, somebody's in their feelings, and for them, their feelings and their embarrassment or their I didn't mean it, or maybe I feel stupid because other people seem to know that and aren't racists, you know, I think that what they are is ignorant, uninformed, and I'm not any of those things. So sometimes we have to change our behaviors or our language as we're calling people in, calling people out, yeah, on that as well.
And I've vacillated, and you and I have talked privately and other, and maybe even on our podcast about this sort of, you know, do you lovingly call white folks in or do you angrily smack them on the nose when we fuck up? And I, yeah, go back and forth, and I don't know if it's anything other than my mood at that moment, and that's not really a very effective way of being. But I realize I've maybe inadvertently, subconsciously, I don't know. So I said earlier that white folk have really taken this word racist to be the new, you know, that is the new racism, being called a racist. And then even worse, this sort of like, oh, I'm being called a racist just because I'm white. I'm born with some original sin for being white, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I've honestly, if I'm looking back as you were talking about language and how we do it, I started thinking about my own usage, and I probably have gone more towards, when something like a microaggression happens or there's a smaller incident, to enable, I think, and I don't know if I've got any actual proof, but I think I've changed my language to hope that the other person is more receptive to it, because I know that the word racist has such a like knee-jerk reaction. So I've said times that, like, what you've just said or done was framed by supremacist ideology, and it inadvertently upholds systems of supremacy. And I don't know if that helps anybody. Maybe it's a little bit like more like intellectual ivory tower way of saying, you fucking dumbass, you just did some racist shit. You know what I mean? But I don't have any proof or any sort of evidence that that's working. But I do sense in my own communication, I've moved away from, in particular in this regard, microaggressions and ways that we white folk are inadvertently or subconsciously upholding supremacist systems. I generally acknowledge that rather than say it's racist. You know, I try to get into that non-binary way by saying, hey, you know, we all uphold systems of supremacy in a variety and myriad of ways, some conscious and unconscious. And maybe what you just did, you don't know, you don't realize it, but that was framed by some supremacist ideology, and it actually upholds systems of supremacy. And that, you know, maybe they listened to it. I don't know. But I know I've changed my language a little bit away from the dreaded racist word.
Well, and I go back and forth, to be honest. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all for this, because there are different circumstances that require different responses.
True.
And relationships, too, right? Different relationships and power dynamics. I know that there are some times that I'll do kind of what you just talked about and use language that's a little more intellectual. And then there's a, you know, I've got a sermon that I've preached in a number of different congregations where I just flat out say, I am racist. And this is, and I break down how I, and how that came about, you know, what's the environment, and then how my behavior can uphold the white supremacy and the systems of supremacy. But I use that language very intentionally. So because of the situation and because of the power dynamic that happens when you're, you know, when you're a faith leader and you're being honest about some of this stuff. And say, the first time I ever, that sermon, it's changed over the years, but the first time I used a version of that was right after Trayvon Martin was killed, and dealing with that from the pulpit. So there's times when it is appropriate to be really blunt and bold, and then there's other times when it's appropriate to be more relational. And so I don't know that there's a, this is absolutely always good, this is absolutely always bad. And if I decide to change how I'm using things, I don't think it necessarily means that I'm getting soft or I'm not interested in really being a social justice warrior. It's just that there's, you know, you gotta look at your circumstance, look at context again. Context works. Yeah. Important for this too.
I think someone once told me in a polite way, Drew, you're not matching your passion with the audience's receptiveness. Okay, you're politely telling me I was kind of rude to these folks, but I think you and I have been connected on Twitter for a long time, or at least a few years now, more than a few years, and I do think I remember very early on identifying with you and your timeline for the way that you talked about this stuff, that you included yourself, that it wasn't like, you know, white people this. It was like, no, I, you know what I mean? And that's something that I've had to be, I take a lot of care. I recraft things frequently. I'll go back and reread it and say, oh, you know what? I didn't intend to, but I'm not including me here. And I want to make it very clear that I'm just as guilty. I'm just as culpable. I'm just as in this mess as anybody else. So the next one was, where are we here?
Think they're just being honest.
Oh yeah, they're just saying what they mean.
Honest. Listen, haven't you read the studies about black on black crime? Listen, these are just facts, and I'm just being honest about what I mean.
FBI table 40 fucking 3 people or whatever, that FBI crime table. People throw that shit at me all the time. Like, oh, look at black people commit more crime. It's like, you know, there's a lot more nuance to it than that. But I like this one paragraph where so one of the characters, I'll just read the sentence, is Yvonne. There's Natasha. So Yvonne confronts Natasha about the genetic intelligence thing. She tells Natasha, stop spreading that crap on Facebook. What Yvonne means to say is, that's not true. Stop spreading those awful lies. But what her friend hears is, yeah, I admit that's true, but it's not nice and it makes black people feel bad. So don't say it in front of people. Right. And I thought that was an interesting nuance, because I think people do that all the time about stuff that we know is wrong, but it's also racist. And we'll just say, stop doing that. And it's not stop doing that because it's false and it's incorrect and it's all these other things. It's perceived as, well, that's not nice, so you shouldn't do that. So then when people do it, it's like, well, I'm just being honest, you know?
Right. Come on, we know if we're going to not be nice, like, we don't have to worry about the niceness. Let's be honest, right? Because honesty is more important than sugarcoating it or being politically correct. Except that, like, as it says later, actual correctness, like actual scientific proof in actual studies, shows that it's nonsense. This nonsense that you're putting out here, right? Yeah. This has been a discredited study that no one's looked at for the last 45 years. And yet here it comes, you know, a new wave of it. It's being shown on Facebook or it's being shared on Twitter and you fell into it, but actually it's nonsense, right?
Yeah. And you add that to the propensity for ideologues to entrench themselves in a position and then surround themselves with evidence that supports that, rather than actual, like, you know, open to understanding and learning, right? So you tell them, like, well, this is 45-year-old crap. Let's go find more recent crap that supports their view. Right. You know what I mean? Like, there's a shitty outlet that's producing content that supports your horrible views right now. You know,
yep.
It exists.
Yep. But I'm here. I'm just telling the truth. Come on. I'm just being honest about it.
Yeah. Like, this next one's, I think, real important. They didn't mean to be racist. They didn't mean to be racist. I got this quickly and early in my sort of work on internalized depression and just oppressive behaviors and thoughts. Doesn't matter what I mean. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. Just summate, the intent is zero. It's all an outcome. And I think that you can apply that to a lot of different things in life, not just supremacy and oppressive behavior, but, you know, your intent, you know, I shouldn't say it doesn't matter. Okay. If you tell me that your intent wasn't to harm me, I accept that. And I appreciate hearing that's good to know that you didn't do this intentionally. But the end result is I was still harmed. You know, you telling me that you didn't intend to punch me in the face doesn't help me with my broken jaw. You know, maybe it makes me feel a little bit better, right? I'm not saying intent is pointless, but when it comes to, in particular, aggressions, microaggressions, race, the things we do and say that uplift and uphold systems of supremacy, our intent is to do that. And like we talked before, that's occluded, right? Supremacy makes us believe as white people that we're not different, that we're not in this different position. So when we say things like, oh, you know, I didn't mean it like that, that we really kind of probably didn't mean it that way, but that's the problem. You know, like, right. You know, the outcome is still bad. And, you know, your thinking on it is probably framed by supremacy. And your thinking on it is like that it's no big deal. But yeah.
Well, and some of this, I think, is actually not thinking about it, because as white people, generally, we don't have to think critically about race. So we don't recognize the bigger context that it's in and what it's a part of. So that it's not even that, oh, I thought it through and I still decided to say that. No, probably you didn't, because we don't have to.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've described that as the paint myself into a corner, right? Where I say something kind of stupid or whatever, and then somebody says something and I knee jerk kind of defend it because of supremacists or other behaviors. And then once I've done that, I've like made a wall that I kind of have to, you know, I've built an erroneous facade that I now need to maintain. And it's like painting myself into a corner that I can't defend. It's like, yeah. And at what point do you have to get out of that position? The only thing to do is say, ooh, boy, was I wrong and I acted stupid. And the more I act stupid, the harder it is for me to admit that I acted wrong. Like, once I've acted stupid for 2 days, it's like, it's hard to come back and be like, well, I've been really fragile for the last week, but please forgive me, you know?
That's tough. I love the example that they use in here. I'm going to read it real quick. Here's what it feels like to receive unintentional racism. A guy is driving to get groceries, and on the way, he runs you over with his car. When you complain, he calls you a pedantic jerk. So whatever, and then this, we're back to this Natasha and Yvonne as the two people and the characters in this article. Natasha thinks whatever racial slur or stereotype she might have incidentally brought up is far less serious than the point she was making or the joke she was telling. And those Yvonnes out there are tunnel vision nitpickers. And then this is why, oh, come on, I didn't mean to be racist. I was just trying to tell a funny joke. Gets the same looks as, oh, come on, I didn't mean to run down a pedestrian. I was just trying to get groceries.
And it should.
My intent was to get groceries. I didn't mean to run down the pedestrian. Come on, that shouldn't count. My intention was I needed to get groceries. Come on. No big deal.
And the tunnel vision nitpickers, and folks, we mentioned a lot white fragility. It's a theory Robin DiAngelo wrote some years ago. And we'll, I think it's on one of the notes, and if not, we'll include it here. But you should understand it and learn it and know the fragility conditioned response. But nitpicking a single thing is part and parcel with white fragility. You know, so someone will have a complete argument, very succinct, and you'll say that one word. That one word you said in this entire paragraph of you know, documentation, this one word, I don't like that word. So I'm going to argue about this word.
You missed the point. Come on, yeah. You missed it. That wasn't the point. Come on, just ignore that part. What I really meant was, yeah.
Yeah. So the last one, scroll down. They totally wouldn't mind if it was them. And I'm not sure if I hear this as much. But
well, we've talked about this a little bit already today when somebody says, and here's their example. Why do people get so upset when I use the N-word? I don't mind if somebody calls me a honky. In fact, it makes me laugh.
Yeah. Not the same.
Not the same. The context is totally, totally different. Again, this is a bigger picture we're looking at.
Yeah.
You can't separate this moment from the history that brings us to where we are and the context that we're in.
Yeah, and I think I don't know, I lost my train of thought there. I was reading this, the rest of this paragraph again about Yvonne and Natasha. I don't hear that as much, but maybe I don't interact with people at that level that are saying those kind of things. Like, what would mine as me?
I've actually heard it. Oh, I'm trying to remember the exact example, but it happened at some point over the last couple of weeks. I was in a conversation with somebody where this versions of this came up, and it's about deflection because, and really what it's this feeling thing, right? Where I don't want to feel the fact that I just hurt somebody.
I've got a good example. Sorry. The touching of hair. That's okay. I see that. In fact, I know I've seen it with that. Like, oh, I wouldn't mind. Here, you can touch my hair. Right? Like thinking like, oh, I'm just touching your hair. That's not a big deal. I don't mind if you touch my hair. Well, but your hair hasn't been othered and ostracized and put in a box and limited and policed, and people don't come and touch your hair all the time because they think it's different and unique and ooh, let me touch it. You know, that doesn't happen to your hair. So, you know, your hair hasn't been systemically policed for forever. So yeah, of course you don't mind people touching your hair, and you don't at that moment think of it as you, when someone reaches out and touches a black person's hair, they're not thinking what I've just done is taken away this person's authority and agency, and I've just reinforced centuries old stereotypes and tropes about white people and black hair, right? They don't think that. They think like, oh, I'm just touching your hair. So then the inverse is, well, I wouldn't mind if it was me, but it's not the same. The inverse is just is not the same. And the example of the N-word, like, good Lord, is it not the same? Like and I say this to white people that try to defend their usage of the N-word, and I honestly mean it. If you honestly knew and you really had a clear understanding of the pain behind that word, the damage that's been inflicted with that word, the power dynamic behind that word, you'd never even fucking think it. If you even knew a fraction of the pain associated with that word, you would never even think it, much less defend your fucking right to use it. Forgive me for swearing. You know, people that are like, they said wiki said and it ended in GA instead of GR. It's like, no, double no, you just can't, don't ever think it. And so that one always is just to me bizarre, but I think the hair one I've seen where people say, like, oh, I wouldn't mind if it was me. Like, yeah, but it's just not the same. You can't, they're not equitable at all.
So I've heard or I learned a couple of years ago this paradigm, and now I've taken it in a much bigger to heart. And this idea of the golden rule is part of what's fueling this. And you know, the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That idea is, that concept is actually in almost all of major faith traditions around the world, have some version of the golden rule. However, it's stated differently, but Buddhists have it, Muslims, it's within the Jewish tradition, certainly within the Christian tradition. I mean, really, like, there's like 19, 20 different faith traditions that all experience and hold up some version of the golden rule. And that's been really where I think where some of this comes from. Well, you know, I'm okay with somebody touching my hair, so do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I'm okay with it, so why can't I touch your hair?
Yeah.
And a couple of years ago, I heard somebody reframe this as when you're looking at actually working, you know, interculturally, which honestly we all have to do, whether we recognize it or not. We're all working interculturally. We're all living in an intercultural world. Like, doesn't matter what corner of the, you know, feeling like you're completely isolated, guess what? Everybody, even in your small little community, is not just like you. So this this new paradigm was brought up, which I'm now really holding up, and I find it more important. And she called it the platinum rule. And the platinum rule, which is, you know, if you look at platinum is more expensive than gold. It's more precious than gold. So it's the next step. It's the next evolution,
right?
Of rules.
Golden is do unto others.
And this one was do unto others as they would have done to them. So it means do unto others what they want to have done for them, not what you want to have done for you. Treat people how they want to be treated.
Boy, that's a good distinction. And I think in terms of support and how we help folks out, far too often folks run in with what they think a community needs. And then the community is like, well, wait a minute, why are you running in with this white knight savior? You know, we don't need this. We need something different, right? So that's very interesting. I like that a lot, the platinum rule. Instead of do unto others.
Rule, it can really apply to a lot of things. Like you're talking about for organizing, for communities, for helping, for all those different things. Thinking about really moving things, evolving from the golden rule to the platinum rule can help change some of our behavior and change the paradigm, this white supremacist paradigm and the white supremacist behavior and racist behavior that we can embody. Really moving to that platinum rule can help shift that.
Yeah, I like that a lot, the platinum rule. And you're right, there's that golden rule is in every major religion, and it sounds pretty good. It made a lot of sense for a long time, I think. But I like the platinum rule. I like that
and
a lot.
And it's certainly better than probably the way behavior had, right? It's better than just being
selfish
others.
Yeah.
And only going out for me, and I'm going to just do what I want, and I don't give a damn about you or anybody else. It's definitely a step up, but as we're working more interculturally, which again, we all are, because when you look at culture encompasses and embodies so many different intersections that, you know, we're not just looking at one thing. Sometimes, you know, families now are often intercultural, and I don't just mean interracial families that have that aspect. That certainly brings another element. But, you know, like in my family, my family of origin, my biological family that I was raised in, we're an intercultural family to the degree that we've got some queer people in our family, being me, which changes the dynamic of if the family wants to work in that way and wants to pay attention to that nuance, right? It changes it. The fact that we're not all Christians in my family changes things. The fact that we've got other kinds of intersections with some people with mental health issues, right? So truly, even within families, we should be thinking interculturally. And so that platinum rule even can go down to a family level, but it's certainly on communities, in faith communities, in school systems, in work situations, in organizing, starting to move up to that, I think could really change the playing field.
Yeah, and it's a, you know, I use the phrase and it's not unique to me, but when you know better, you do better, right? And the platinum rule is kind of like that, right? Okay, the golden rule is good. Like you said, it was better. And now that we know better, we're going to do better. And you're talking about a family unit and other different groups that things are changing. And as things change, you become more multicultural. You've got different elements in the family unit. You've got to know better and do better. And you grow, and that's kind of how things go. And I think that's maybe a good segue. I'm going to skip the fourth bullet point on the notes there, Rev, and go to this. Are we raising racists? So we talked a little bit about the family and just sort of, you know, societal conditioning, microaggressions. And folks, I actually hear this a lot, I would say. But so this concept that, you know, babies aren't born racist. You know, babies aren't, you know, newborns aren't racist. And we've got to raise, and I sell a shirt, raise better white people. You know, we've got to raise better white people. And I guess there's two components. One's the family unit, right? The micro, and then societally on the macro. Certainly, we're not doing a very good job on the macro, but I think we can do a better job on the individual, the micro level. I know you've got children in your family. You're raising some folks that are white presenting, correct?
Oh, yeah, white presenting. They're not just white presenting. They're all white. Yeah, they're white. they're going to hold certain privilege that regardless, I think you're right about that too. Regardless of the fact that we're working really hard on how we're raising them, the family, the larger community, you know, the society is giving them sometimes very different lessons and messages than we are. So one way or the other, we have to work even harder, which is what I think. I like this article that we'll put in. It's from the New York Times. It's an opinion on the opinion pages, and it's a really, I like it in that it's saying one of the things which we've already talked about in this podcast already. One of the things we have to do to combat the systemic and sometimes individual, you know, racism and supremacy, is that we have to be conscious about this, and we have to talk about it, and we have to bring it more out into the open. And what a lot of what they're talking about in this article is how do we talk about race and with white kids? How do we talk about the disparities? How do we talk about systemic racism? How do we talk about supremacy with white kids? Kids of color have to have, they learn about race from a very early age and they have different kinds of talks. But generally, because we're white, because we're that quote unquote norm that other people are othered against, our whiteness is invisible.
Yeah. And, sorry, I remember you mentioned it before that we never think about race. And that's what I loved about this article. And you talked about black folks having lots of talks. Within the black community, it's referred to as the talk when a parent has to talk to their black child or the black presenting child about race and about the fact that, you know, you and your white peers aren't going to be treated the same. When the police roll up, you're going to have different experiences and you might have to behave slightly differently, you know, and that's it's just I don't say it's heartbreaking, but every black parent has that talk. They call it the talk. It was on Blackish. It was a central point of TV show. And we never, as white folks, have any zeitgeist moment to talk about race with our white children. We don't have that. We have to think about race. We have to manufacture. We have to go out of our way to find those moments and educate those kids at every instance. Because if we don't, society will.
And the some of the pieces in this article, which we'll put into the notes, and I really recommend taking a look at it, that this really, you know, hits on is what a lot of us, especially on, I would say, the liberal side, but actually I've got conservative relatives that do the same thing of we're all equal.
Yep.
We're all the same under our skin. Because I have some particularly right-wing religious folks, you know, God made us all the same. Therefore, there is no racism. So it's not just liberal side. That's just kind of what's probably happened in the last 40 years in a bigger sense in the way that we've been able to push the overt racism underground. It's come up in this we're all equal. We're all the same. And yet it's not, because people aren't treated the same. And so as white people, then we have we tend to teach that real, you know, this message that is not accurate, and it's actually winds up being ineffective and unhelpful. I'm going to read a quote here from this article about when we don't talk about things. It says the consequences are serious. When we don't talk honestly with white children about racism, they become more likely to disbelieve or discount their peers when they report experiencing racism. But we're all equal becomes a rote response that actually blocks white children from recognizing or taking seriously racism when they see it or hear about it.
Yeah, and that point there, I have that argument with, so I wouldn't say a lot of folks, but I engage with a wide variety of white people all across variety of spectrums and demographics and views and opinions, but I have probably butted heads, maybe sometimes the hardest, with the love everyone, you know, like love will win, love trumps hate, just, you know, love will, you know, all we gotta do is love everybody, we're all equal, love will do it. And so we're talking about casual racism. We're talking about ways in which our views, opinions, and language can inadvertently uphold systems of supremacy. I'm of the opinion this love everyone, it gives white folk a pass on acknowledging and being accountable for our behavior, right? For the South African Truth and Reconciliation type hearing. We've never done anything like that with regards to race, including our current atrocities, our ongoing atrocities against blackness and black folk that are happening today. So this love everybody, it just for me feels very hollow. It feels like I've been stepping on your neck and shitting on you for 400 years, and I'm going to relieve the pressure just a little bit. You should be thanking me. You know, let's just love everybody.
I agree with you. Here's the thing too that I think also it messes up. It also this romanticism of the idea of love, right? That it's easy, that we can do it, that it's just if we love everybody, everything will be magically perfect, is also just a flat out a lie.
Yeah, and it's also it focuses on the individual, right? The concept being, well, if everyone just doesn't have hate in their heart, things will be better. Well, what about the systems? What
Absolutely.
About the institutions? What about the, you know, like there's literally like, what about prison? What about policing? Like, do you think if we all just love everybody that industrialized prison complex is going to go away?
Right.
Do you think we just love everybody that cops are going to stop killing black people? I don't think
right.
so.
No, and also I know, and I know that you know, and the grown-ups that I know that actually, when you think about love and really loving somebody, it's hard work. You actually have to be in relationship with people. It is not easy. It's not even. It's often not pretty. It involves struggle. It involves figuring out ways to get through to the next side. So this idea, it's just also, this idea about love, it's just also, it's watering down what love really is to think, oh, I can just love everybody. Listen, I got two kids. One of them's two, one of them's almost five. And sometimes I love both of them. And the only way I can keep loving them is to go through the struggles that it takes to be able to stay in relationship with them. So even if we could actually love everybody in the ways that we're honest about what love is, because it's not something that happens in a vacuum either, it has context. It has, yeah. It's relational, right? If we really could love everybody, then that, I think that that's true, but that's not how it's being used, right?
It's a way
to stop talking about it. This love everybody, we're all the same. If we just love, it'll be okay, is actually a way to stop the conversation.
Absolutely.
And to stop the work.
And I go back to your golden platinum rule. The way that I feel most people envision this love everybody is I'm going to outwardly in my heart of hearts and in my own mind, I don't hate black people. So I'm going to treat black people kindly and nicely. And I'm going to do these things. I there's love in my heart for black people. The concept that if everyone has that would A, end racism is wrong, but B, it still feels like that golden rule. I'm going to love you in the way I want to love you. If you asked a black person, well, what do you want from white people in the form of love? Do you want them to just be kind to you in their heart of hearts and think of you a certain way? Or do you want them to fucking tear down the system of supremacy and act like your lives are at stake? Like, right. You know, like if you ask black people how they want to be loved by white people, get out of town. It ain't fucking just thinking in a heart of heart. Like, so right. I don't mean to keep always be plugging Safety Pin Box, but you know, Leslie is my wife and obviously I see all the content, but so there's different pieces. They ask the black woman being every month. And there's the piece that, you know, the three or four questions, they're always the same. And one is, what would you like white people to stop doing? And a lot of black activists, the black women being, say vote, right? I'd love for black white people. And I laugh at it, but I was like, man, that's some truth. That is some absolute truth. So in the same sense, what would love from white people look like? I guarantee you, it ain't going to look like what white people think it looks like. That's that golden rule versus, well, how do black people want to be loved by us? That's the platinum rule. So even in the concept of this love everybody, I think it's false. It's not, it's a red herring to allow me to stop worrying about things. It's like an excuse and a pass. But B, it's still this, you know, it's rooted in this, I'm going to do this in the way I want to do. It's conditional, right? And love shouldn't be conditional. You know, like an actual, like as you're talking dirty, like in the moment, like you're real and you're together and you're there. It takes work. And that work is because it's not simple and all, you know, flowers and whatnot, you know?
I used to, Marianne Williamson is a spiritual teacher that I used to go hear her lecture in New York over and over again. One of the things she used to talk about how when people talk about wanting to be spiritual and they want to be full of love, it's like they were just pouring pink paint over the problem. Like, it looks fine. It looks good. The underneath is still the problem. But pouring pink paint over this by pouring the word love over it doesn't change the underlying nonsense that is white supremacy, institutionalized racism, and white privilege that is really like tearing apart the undersides of the world that we say that we want. So
yeah,
this idea about, are we raising racists? It's by Jennifer Harvey, by the way, in the New York Times, just to give credit where credit's due here. And this piece that really hit me in reading about this, about how the consequences when we have this rhetoric of, you know, love everybody, we're all equal, you know, there's no difference, God made us all the same. The part about that, especially because I do feel like that's probably, you know, free to be you and me, and that I grew up with that in the 70s, and a lot of that that bigger ideal that came out of the 60s and 70s got really used in a really messed up way, because for me then we didn't then talk about race. I wasn't talked honestly about race as I was growing up. So that we're all equal, that that response is what I learned is to, I was, you know, learned to be, try to be quote unquote colorblind. And so when doing that, that makes it, that is going to, here now I'm part of, this is again, part of that bigger systemic piece where now I'm part of a system until I decide to break out of it. That's going to stop me from taking seriously racism.
Yeah.
And it's not my fault that I came into it, but it is my fault that now it will be my fault if now that I see it, I choose to stay in it and not break free.
Yeah, in that same sense, it's not quite analogous, but the love the sin or hate the sin kind of mentality that some church and faith communities take, it does the same disservice. You know, it's sort of like it doesn't address any of the conflict that an individual might have in a community. It doesn't address any of that individual's needs, right? Whatever the quote unquote sin you think it is, you don't address any of their needs. You just, well, we're going to love you, but we're going to hate this thing that defines you or who you are or this part of you, but we're going to love you, but we hate this one thing that you maybe do, but we're going to love you. Like,
we're going to love you as a concept, but yeah, you as a person, you're out.
We're going to turn a blind eye to a portion of your personality, a person or whoever you are, you know, as you navigate this world, but we're going to love you. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you love somebody and not love them wholly.
You don't, in reality. It's just, this is more pouring pink. That's pouring pink paint over something. You know what I mean? You're not really doing it. It's pretending to do it. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that's maybe, I know we like to keep it close to an hour, and I think that's about around that time. And I do really just love talking with you, Rev. And I really just personally want to thank you for yesterday and being in my white accountability circle and for doing this podcast with me. And just really, really appreciate you and your time and your friendship, and just love you. And thank you so much for doing this with me.
Oh, I'm grateful. I'm so grateful that we kind of stumbled upon being friends over the years, and that it's really grown. And I'm grateful to have that, to have you as part of my accountability group and my friend as we do this, because it's gone past just being accountable. It's like, now I can just call you up and be like, hey man, what's going on? This is what's going on with me. Ugh, I screwed this up. Can you help me talk through it? Or, hey, this great thing happened, and I can send you little videos of my, you know, wacky kids running around in circles in the house. So I
keep them coming. They make my day. And I'll say this too. I know that maybe on wasn't an episode I had with you, but in the earlier versions of the White Privilege podcast, I talked about some of the costs, you know, friends and family and some of the things that being outspoken advocate for racial justice can have. And I absolutely ended a few friendships, you know, maybe ones that weren't necessary, you know, superfluous in some ways. But friendships like yours, that I've gained, through this kind of work are just some of the, I don't want to, like, you know, on this podcast, people don't need to hear, like, you know, our love story and stuff, cause I love you and whatnot, but I do, I feel like I found a kindred spirit, someone like we shared a past life together or something. I feel very close and connected to you in a way that, I don't with a lot of friends. And I've got there's another friend of mine in my accountability circle whom I've only spent time with in person maybe once, but a lot of time online, and we text a lot and communicate a lot, and she helps me in a different manner. But so I've got multiple friendships from this work that are just amazing and profound and deep. So I was, you know, in the beginning I was like, yeah, you know, talking out and you know, being more an advocate of social justice, it's cost me some things and some friendships, but in the long run I've gained infinitely more and better and deeper relationships and friendships, and I absolutely count you as one of those.
I agree. I definitely think we've been through this. We've done other lives together probably. I think you owe me money, I think, from maybe the Byzantine. Some ducats or something.
Touche. I was like the evil fiduciary banker that stole or something. I'm sure I did some colonialist imperialist shit, you know. If it was Byzantine area, I was terrible. my peoples have been bad forever.
I've known you for a long time. That's right.
Well, listen, we'll use our standard sign up. But before we do that, remind folks, subscribe to Safety Pinbox. And I don't just say that because it's my wife. I really do honestly believe that it's a very, very highly valuable tool for white folks that are wanting to be more effective in their allyship. I do the tasks, and I'm ongoing doing one now. I'm not going to talk about it. That would sound performative, but radical compassion. And it's it's something I could have done. I could have done any of these things. This was an opportunity that was there all the time, but having it from Safety Pin as a task, it was like, okay, I'm going to actually do this. And just getting off my butt and being engaged in the local community and helping some folks that need some support and doing it in the platinum rule way, not going in and saying, here's a blanket, but coming in and saying, hey, what do you need? How can I help? I've been doing that for the last month and a half. I haven't even spoken about this with you, Rev, but it has been, you know, I don't know what I thought going into it in terms of my experience and the time. I don't know what my expectation was, but very quickly on, it was like, oh, I'm getting as much, if not more, out of this relationship and engagement than I ever thought I would. The, you know, my wife calls it heart work. Yeah, yep. It was good heart work. And yep. So, you know, there's Safety Pin Box. It is phenomenal. Whether you're really new to justice work, you're kind of working on your internalized oppression and other things, your supremacist ideology, or you're pretty adept and you kind of know what you're doing. I think it's a terrific product. It gives back to Black women and activists doing this work. You know, Black women tend to be the forefront, yet erased oftentimes. And Safety Box has already given back like over $25,000 to Black women. It's incredible. Just incredible.
Hey, and Leslie is not my wife, and I can echo all the things that you just said. This is one of the most important things that you can do. And I agree that the Safety Pin Box format is going to allow you, wherever you are on a spectrum, you can engage it at your level and there will be something to challenge you. So wherever you are, brand new to seasoned, I've been working on this a long time. You'll be able to engage it. It will be able to engage you and further our work to try to do less harm.
Yep. And to that end, check out whiteprivilege.info. That's a compendium and listing of groups that are locally by state that you can find. So not only subscribe to Safety Inbox and work sort of online on your own stuff, you got to get local. And there's other groups. We talked about accountability circles and peers. But at whiteprivilege.info, there's all the surge chapters that's showing up for racial justice. Just I think there's about 200 different organizations listed. Also, teespring.com/ Ferguson Response Store. I'll send a link in the notes here. That's where you can buy, we mentioned today, Raise Better White People. That's a t-shirt that materially supports Leslie Mack and her work. And there's also Black Lives Greater Than White Feelings. I think we've got some new spring colors, so do check those out. Thank you for that. But we'll use our sign-off here, our Feminista Jones signature. Help, don't hinder. Support, don't supplant. Cooperate, don't co-opt. Solidarity, not charity. One person can make a difference. Your passion is a superpower. And I'll add to this for today, work on the platinum mean, not the golden mean. Rev, thank you for your time. And until next time, enjoy.
Good night.